It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a gastroenterologist helps us understand the mysteries of our guts and how we can feel better by eating the right stuff. First, the January 6th House hearings continue as today marked the fourth public hearing this month. The committee discussed former President Trump's pressure campaign when he urged state officials and state legislatures to, quote, find the votes that would swing voting results in his favor for the 2020 presidential election. Today's hearings also discussed the threats made to state and local officials who would not comply to Trump's pressure campaign. Let's take a moment to listen to some of those threats shared publicly in today's hearings.
Public pressure on state officials often grew dangerous in the lead up to January 6th.
What can you and I do to a state legislator besides kill him? Although we should not do that. I'm not advising that, but I mean, what else can you do, right?
The punishment for treason is death.
At the hearing, members of the House said Trump's false claims about election fraud helped create the violence of what became the January 6th Capitol attack. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What was your reaction to what came out of today's hearings? Did anything surprise you? What are your thoughts on the pressure campaign toward officials in a number of states? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Schultz is a professor of political science at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He's the author of the book Politainment, The 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics. David, welcome back to Central Time.
My pleasure to be here again. Thank you to the audience.
Well, what we learned more about today was, I think, the extent of the campaign to pressure officials in state legislatures, secretaries of state, and others. What stood out to you along those lines, David?
To me, what stood out to me was a quote by Rudy Giuliani at one point, who said, "What we have lots of theories, but what not a lot of evidence regarding fraud," or something to that effect. And why I mention that is because what we had across states like Wisconsin, Arizona, Georgia, which came out today, is that there are all kinds of theories being cooked up regarding voter fraud, all types of theories being cooked up about how maybe alternate electors could be picked or how people could throw out the results of an election or decertify it. These were the theories, but there was no evidence to support any of the claims about fraud. And so to me, that quote sums up a lot today. But I also want to say, and again, when you did the introduction, you pointed out I teach election law also at the University of Minnesota. I've been teaching election law for 25 years. And when I was listening to the testimony today, I thought to myself, nobody in their right mind would think that any of these theories had any merit. And the Speaker of the House from Arizona, I think, brought that up really well by saying, there's no evidence, there's no theory. You're asking me to do something that has never been done in American history. That's what stood out for me today.
I want to listen to Arizona Republican State House Speaker Rusty Bowers. He said he did not tell Trump that Trump had won Arizona, contrary to a statement from the former president just earlier today. Here is Bowers talking, saying a member of Congress had also urged him to overturn Arizona's results.
And what did Mr. Biggs ask you to do?
I believe that was the day that the vote was occurring to each state to have certification or to declare the certification of the electors. And he asked if I would sign on both to a letter that had been sent from my state and or that I would support the decertification of the electors. And I said I would not.
Let's talk more about House Speaker Rusty Bowers from Arizona, Republican, conservative. Can you talk about his testimony, what he said about the pressure from the president, members of Congress, as we just heard, and others?
It was a powerful testimony, and it's also important to underscore that he said he voted for Trump in 16, voted for Trump in 20, wanted him to win. But he started to describe this intense pressure being brought to bear upon him in terms of what recalls from the White House, in terms of, I'm going to maybe use the word almost like haranguing from Mayor Giuliani. And what he described here was how there were claims that what? There were what, about 200,000 people who had voted illegally, including what? Dead people voting, illegal immigrants, et cetera, undocumented individuals. And he asked for proof of this. And Giuliani never forwarded it. And then asked for justification, argument for why he should be able to certify the election. And pressed arguments to him, that is by Giuliani, and when he was pushed back, that is when the speaker pushed back and said, we've never been asked to do this before, it was just the intensity of the pressure that I think that was so interesting. And I thought, and I'd be curious what the listeners think too, I thought his testimony was just intensely powerful in terms of somebody who said, I supported Trump, but I took an oath of office to the Constitution and I had to follow what the Constitution says. I think that was pretty powerful testimony in terms of describing his role and in terms of describing the unprecedented level of pressure upon state officials when there's no legal or factual basis to support the claims.
You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Talking to David Schultz from Hamline University and the University of Minnesota about today's January 6th committee hearing in the U.S. House. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Spring Green. Michael, hi.
Hi, I've been listening on the radio, Wisconsin Public Radio, to the hearings today, January 6th committee, and I did hear Ron Johnson's name come up quite a few times, but I'm really not clear what his role is in all of this, and I was wondering if your guests could articulate that for us.
Yeah, that Michael, thanks for bringing that up. The committee shared a text thread from Senator Johnson's aide, his newly appointed that day chief of staff on January 6th, 2021. Text, Johnson needs to hand something to V. POTUS, Vice President of the United States. Please advise. That's going to a Mike Pence staffer. The staffer replies, what is it? Riley, the Johnson staffer, says alternate slate of electors for MI and WI because archivist didn't receive them. And then the Penn staffer says, do not give that to him. So an apparent offer from a Johnson staffer, a Senator Johnson staffer, to bring these so-called alternate electors, a phony or fake electors, people are calling them. David, a lot of people in Wisconsin watching this, what do you think?
This is pretty significant because if this is accurate in terms of this recount, this is starting to connect now Senator Ron Johnson to this larger process of a legal theory of trying to say we can submit alternative electors. Even though we know that this is illegal or not possible to do this, and part of this larger argument that's being made today that the whole idea of fabricating a alternative set of electors, of questioning the certification, was really meant to undermine confidence and create confusion going into Congress, with the hope then that Mike Pence would say, well, we can't be sure, you know, who are the right electors at this point. And so this is important because this is now potentially connecting a member of Congress, again, a representative, senator from Wisconsin, to this broader, let's say, conspiracy involving January 6th.
Johnson's office put out a statement today quoting here, the senator had no involvement in the creation of an alternate set of electors and had no foreknowledge is going to be delivered to our office. This is a staff-to-staff exchange. His new chief of staff contacted the vice president's office, end quote, going on saying, they said we didn't want it, so we didn't bring it to them, but not denying that there was an offer to transmit that slate of electors. Members of the House committee said, maybe we do want to talk to Senator Johnson about this, but I think that's about where they left it on that. Now, talking about this so-called fake elector thing. Now, some of the people involved here in Wisconsin said, we weren't trying to do something that was going to affect January 6th directly. We were saying, if these court challenges, even if they're long shots, if these court challenges tip the balance toward Donald Trump in Wisconsin, here we are. We need to be registered as electors in case things change. We need Republican electors. How is that ultimately used leading up to January 6th?
Well, how it's used at this – well, first off, by the way, by the time we still have these fake electors being talked about, it's well past the court challenges are done, well past the certification of the election. So at this point, there really is no reason to keep sort of pushing this idea of alternative electors that are out there. On top of which, what was happening is that they were submitting fraudulent documents saying that what they in fact were the rightfully chosen electors. So this is a problem with fraud. And so all of this fits into January 6th in a couple of ways. One, in terms of the, again, creating supposedly the confusion that would give the vice president justification to say, we just don't know who the correct electors are in Wisconsin. Therefore, let's set them to the side. Let's maybe have an investigation or something like that. But also this fed into the narrative leading into the speech for Donald Trump on January 6th of saying we have what? We have widespread voter fraud out there, or officials are doing things to prevent legitimate electors, that is our electors, from being seated. So this is where it fits in. Although we don't have the full pieces or all the pieces of the puzzle in place yet, this is where it seems to be going at this point.
David Schultz is with us, professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota, with us today to talk about today's January 6th public hearings and claims of election fraud from then-President Trump. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions, your questions. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota, author of the book Politainment, The 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics, looking at today's hearing of the House January 6th committee. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your reactions. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Samantha is with us in Whitehall. Samantha, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Love the show. Anyway, I was just kind of wondering why people are believing all this crap, you know, even whether you like Trump or you don't, or you wanted Biden or you don't, or whatever, because I've got some friends that are convinced, well, the one passed away, but when he was still alive, and his wife is still alive, but they were convinced that Biden stole the election. And they were just totally convinced about it, just like with the coronavirus. They're convinced that there's stuff and they're not going to take it because they believe this stuff. Now, why do people believe those are just two good incidences? But why do people believe that there's all this junk about those two things or anything, but not want to, you know, go research it first to see, did Biden really do this? Is there aborted fetuses in this coronavirus or anything else? They did, you know, in the shot or anything else.
Gotcha, Samantha. Thanks for the call. So, David, we have this contrast in real time. We're hearing tape of Georgia officials patiently explaining what had happened in their election. That information is there in real time. But there is a reality, as Samantha says, that a lot of people still believe a lot of the claims that were being debunked as early as December of 2020. Yeah.
Okay, a couple of things going on here. First off, when the president of the United States says something, generally that person carries a lot of weight in terms of what they have to say. We want to hope that they're truthful, that they're credible. And also, the president of the United States gets a lot of media attention. And so for a lot of people, if the president says something, they're going to naturally believe him. I think a second thing that's going on here is the fact that we clearly have bubbles that we live in. We've talked all about this, you know, that we live in our little bubbles on the social media. We live in our bubbles with our friends and so forth. And everybody else around us believes the same thing. If all of my friends are saying, I voted for Donald Trump, and you're wondering, my gosh, everybody I know voted for Donald Trump. How could Biden have won? And then finally, you know, we're looking at, a media environment now that is so fragmented that you have what, Fox News, for example, that's broadcasting one set of facts or one set of opinions regarding what happened. So put these all together, the bubbles, the president speaking, sort of the bully pulpit that he gets, and sort of, let's say, the fractured media, those become pretty powerful, and they help reinforce what cognitive scientists say is what our own confirmation biases. We look out there, we search for information that confirms our biases. And so all kinds of reasons why that's happening. And to this day, we have lots of people who are still probably saying, well, gosh, I still think the election was stolen because the ex-president says so. All my friends voted for Trump. I think that's partly what's going on here. Certainly not a definitive answer, but part of the answer.
Thanks for the call. Just before we go back to callers, a running theme today was whether it's a elected Republican in Arizona or Georgia or election officials. We heard from Shay Moss and then tape testimony from her mom, Ruby Freeman. The threats, the harassment in person, at their houses, death threats, rape threats to spouses that came out of all of this. What did we see there today?
Yeah, well, it's probably bad enough that we saw efforts to try to come up with fabricated theories or fabricated evidence, but this was really kind of, I don't know, thuggish behavior also we're hearing about here, where people, even including longstanding Republicans, not that it's justified for anybody, but including people who are longstanding Republicans, were essentially, you know, threatened. I mean, as I'm listening to it, I think of the words like thuggery, or I think of what, almost like extortion, or it sort of sounded like, I don't know, almost like an organized crime type of effort to try to pressure people or threaten people. And that's a pretty scary notion that's coming out in terms of these threats of force, these threats of coercion against officials or their family or children. This is the first, I think, really today that I've really heard of that. And I think it's one of the more depressing or dark bits of new information that came out today.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I think you'll agree with me that Trump was president officially until January 20th. So he had a responsibility as the executive branch to make sure that the election was fair and whatnot. So my question is this. If Trump was so wrong in asking for a delay in the Electoral College vote to investigate claims of fraud, why did several U.S. senators agree with him and urge the same thing, including Ted Cruz and other senators? I think there was close to a dozen senators urging a delay in the Electoral College vote.
Jeff, thanks for the call. There were other senators. I believe Senator Johnson had planned to at least object to some of the counts as well, but changed after the insurrection. David, the role of some Republican U.S. senators also asking for a delay.
Okay, first I want to point out and say that by the time we got to January 6th, we had already had extensive litigation, I think over 60 cases brought that Trump had lost. There had been recounts, there had been state certifications, so that by the time we got to January 6th, it was overwhelming that there was no voter fraud, there was no dispute at this point. Trump had his opportunity through his attorneys and he lost. Now, part of what I'm thinking we're going to start to hear now moving forward after today's hearing is who else was involved? Who else has been involved in terms of any types of conspiratorial action?
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Tom now in Madison. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon. I think in the full course of time, it will be revealed that Donald Trump's life was criminal enterprise from the get-go. But the point I want to make is that we have here in Wisconsin a member of our Wisconsin Elections Commission, Bob Spindell, who served as a false and faithless elector. And he has not been disciplined, sanctioned, or removed from that body. And I have a big problem with that. This guy who's on a board to oversee our elections participated in outright fraudulent activity.
Tom, thanks for the call. David, is it inherently fraudulent for that? He is right. Bob Spindell is on the Elections Commission, also one of the would-be electors. Is it fraud, as Tom suggests? And you might have to get a bit lawyerly here. I don't know.
Okay. Is it fraud? If in fact I don't think it's fraud per se. Could there be conflicts of interest? Could there have been something that he could be prosecuted for in terms of fraud in a different, I guess I'm going to rephrase myself here and say that there could be criminal fraud if in fact he tried to do certain things that he knew were deceptive with the effort of trying to maybe obstruct a governmental proceeding or deceive public officials. So in that sense, maybe you're right. Maybe it is the caller's right. Maybe there is some type of criminal fraud here about that action. Him serving on the board, though, may be a different issue about conflicts of interest. But you may have both of those issues potentially applying to him.
Thanks for the call. We heard from Chris in Prairie du Sac, who wonders if the outcome of the hearings here might or might not lead to former President Trump being charged with something. What are your thoughts on what would go into making that decision? Won't ask you to predict what's going to happen, though.
Sure. I've always thought that the hearings from the opening night with Representative Cheney sounded like the beginning of a criminal trial, her opening statement and laying out the arguments. And potentially the president could be charged with efforts to try to obstruct or impede a government proceeding, that is the counting of electoral votes. He could be, and there's been investigations in Georgia regarding, was he trying to intimidate public officials? And depending on where they go, these hearings could, and we don't know, could lead to an indictment of the president or the former president of the United States. That's one of the possible end games for these hearings. And we're just going to have to see if that's where it goes.
And briefly, what are you watching for now? The next hearing scheduled for Thursday afternoon.
What I'm looking for at this point is, again, now trying to connect in. Perhaps connect in some members of Congress, trying to connect in the efforts between what was done at the state level and what done at the congressional level. But mostly I'm looking to see how they start to now show a broader conspiracy, starting to connect all these different things that we're seeing out there. The January 6th riot, what the president was doing, what at the federal level, what's happening with Pence, what's happening at the state level. Can they now start to tie all this together? That's what I want to see.
David, thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you to the audience.
That's David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University and of law at the University of Minnesota, author of the book Politainment, The 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics. David joined us to talk about today's January 6th hearings and former President Trump's 2020 pressure campaign. Coming up after the news, a gut health expert gives us some tips on keeping our digestive systems in shape and what that can do for our overall health as well. Plus some food advice, what to eat, what not to eat. I never do this. But coffee? Which list is it on? We'll find out. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. That was a tease, eh? You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a Wisconsin native competing on the NBC show American Ninja Warrior, using it to promote math and science education. Now, we may not like to talk about it, but a lot of us have problems with our digestive systems. Just check out the wide variety of products in your local drugstore that help with symptoms of those problems. Our next guest says there's good news. We can tackle a lot of these issues with food, including fiber. A study published by the National Library of Medicine says 95% of Americans aren't getting the recommended amount of fiber. About 60 to 70 million Americans are affected by digestive diseases. Our next guest's secret to gut health, for starters, eat more plants. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about your gut health, how our digestive system works, how it connects to other maybe health problems? Have you made a conscious effort to get more fiber into your diet? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Will Bulsiewicz is a gastroenterologist. He's New York Times bestselling author of the book Fiber Fueled and just out the Fiber Fueled Cookbook, inspiring plant-based recipes to turbocharge your health. Dr. Bulsiewicz, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to have a conversation with you.
Well, in your line of work, I imagine a lot of people are willing to talk about their gut health, but I think in general, maybe we try to sweep it under the rug. How big a deal is our digestive system as a source of a lot of our health problems in this country?
Oh, gosh. I mean, where to begin with that? You know, when we think about our life, first of all, digestion really means access to nutrients, and nutrients that are essential for us to be healthy humans. But it goes far beyond this. If you zoom in for a moment, what you're going to discover if you were to look inside your colon, which is the large intestine, is that there's an entire community of microorganisms that exist. They take up residence within our colon. We call it the gut microbiome. And this gut microbiome, this is a new and emerging, very exciting area within science. I mean, we're really sort of enthusiastic about what we're discovering here. And part of it is because it's connected to not just our digestion, but also to our metabolism, our immune system, our hormones, our mood, our brain health, our energy levels. And you take a step back and you look at everything that's happening in our country, and I could go down the line and we could start looking at all these conditions, and I would just point out to you how every single one of them ends up connected back to the gut in one way or another.
Right. So it's not just about, you know, the obvious stuff, though that's important, the stomach aches, the trouble in the bathroom, whatever. It seems like as I follow some of this microbiome research in our guts, a lot of things that I would have no thought that is connected to my digestion might be connected to my digestion.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like we think about the food that we eat, and there's this optimistic view that many of us have that if we could just change our diet, perhaps we could improve our health, reduce our exposure to diseases. Well, anytime we talk about food, we're talking about these gut microbes. You really can't separate them. If you show me what a person is eating, I could predict what their gut microbiome looks like. And if you show me what their gut microbiome looks like, I could tell you what they've been eating. And so this is where, you know, food really translates into these microbes, which translates into sort of the way that our body works. And that's a fascinating thing because they're not even human.
Before we get into some concrete steps we can take, you have a personal story. You're a gastroenterologist and you're trying to figure out what was wrong with a patient called you. Can you talk us through your story and what led you down this microbiome path?
Yeah, well, I'm a gastroenterologist whose origins in medicine start in Chicago, and I was a chief medical resident at Northwestern, and I interviewed at the University of Wisconsin gastroenterology program in Madison. This was 13, 14 years ago. But, you know, during this phase of my life, I was working extremely hard, and convenience foods really took up residence in my diet because they fit so perfectly. They were cheap, they were quick, they were easy, they tasted good. And the problem is that I thought I was invincible, but then these issues from a health perspective started to mount. And it almost feels like I woke up one day about 10 years ago and I was 50 pounds overweight. I had high blood pressure, I had high cholesterol, was depressed, I was anxious, I had extremely low self-esteem, even though my career was taking off. And I needed a way to fix this. And what I discovered, you know, the sort of ironic thing is that I, the gastroenterologist, I needed to heal my gut. And when I changed my diet, when I drifted away from those convenience foods that really were the central focus of my diet, and I started to consume more foods that were high in fiber, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, seeds, nuts, and legumes, it actually, getting my health back was almost effortless. It just happened. And so as a medical doctor, you know, I sit in a room with patients and I look them in the eye, and these are people that I care about. And when you discover something that transforms your own life as a person, I can't help but want to also bring that to my patients. And so that was a transformative moment in my career.
We're talking to Dr. Will Balsowitz, a gastroenterologist, author of the books Fiber Fueled and the Fiber Fueled Cookbook. You can join in if you have a gut health question at 800-642-1234. If you're wondering if a food is hot or not when it comes to your microbiome, to the well-being of your digestive system, call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Balsowitz, you've already mentioned fiber. I think we've all heard the idea, eat more fiber. What is it? What's going on in our gut microbiome that fiber is so good for?
You know, it's time for us to rethink fiber. We need to fire whoever the PR agent for fiber was in the past. We need to revise this because we've been sort of projected this story that's very boring. You know, grandma stirs this orange drink and that way she can have a bowel movement. And that's sort of the vision of fiber that most of us have. But instead, what I see is something that's really exciting and, dare I say, sexy. It's breaking through in science and it's telling a very powerful story. Because when we consume fiber, which, by the way, it's not hard to find, all plants have fiber. So every single fruit, vegetable, whole grain, seed, nut, and legume, if you eat something that I just listed, you're getting fiber and you're doing good for your gut microbes. Because what happens is the fiber actually is not something that we're able to digest as humans. So it passes through our small intestine, all 15 feet of it, and it arrives into the colon, into this place that I was describing earlier where the gut microbiome lives. And they get into a feeding frenzy. This is their preferred food. And much like us, when they are well fed, they become stronger. They become more powerful. They become more capable of doing their job. And fiber is their preferred food. And when they consume it, they don't just get stronger. They actually turn around and they repay the favor to us immediately on the spot. They transform the fiber. It stops being fiber and it turns into the most healing, most anti-inflammatory compounds that I've ever come across in my 20 years of studying medicine. The short chain fatty acids. These short chain fatty acids, we could go throughout the entire body because literally they're affecting you from the tip of your toes to the top of your head. But they have healing effects everywhere they go, and that includes in terms of your digestion, metabolism, hormones, immune system, your brain health. It's all there.
So fiber, clearly a rock star. Now, I teased before this conversation, Dr. Bolsowitz, coffee. A lot of people curious about this. I saw you have strong feelings about coffee and its contribution to our gut microbiome. Where does it fall?
Oh, well, first of all, let me just acknowledge my implicit bias, because I will look for any study that supports the consumption of coffee. But it's actually quite interesting, because what we have discovered is that regular coffee consumption actually does change the gut microbiome, and it's in a beneficial way. And so it's not that coffee is bad in any way. In fact, I would argue that coffee is good for us, but instead, sometimes the things that we add to coffee aren't necessarily good for us. So if we could drift towards versions of coffee that either are black or are including things that are more healthful, then, I mean, truly, we're starting our day off with something that's good for our gut microbes.
And fermented foods. I love them. I like pickles and things like that. I hear it from you and others that it's good. But, you know, sometimes that jar of pickles isn't like an active culture, a live culture. Do I have to be careful about the kinds of pickles and sauerkrauts and things like that that I eat?
Well, in a perfect world, what you want is you want living food. And what's exciting about pickles or sauerkraut or other forms of fermented foods is that they include probiotic microbes, so that you actually have the beneficial bacteria. They include prebiotics. If people haven't heard this term, let me introduce you. Prebiotic basically means the food that feeds our gut microbes. So any pickle or sauerkraut or plant-based fermented food is going to have these prebiotics. And so we were speculating, Rob, when I wrote my first book, Fiber Fueled, to me, it lined up so well. It was hard for me to deny that fermented foods, they have to be good for us. But what's exciting is that less than a year ago, Stanford University, actually some people that I am friends with, professors Christopher Gardner and Justin Sonnenberg at Stanford, they did an intervention study. And they started feeding people fermented foods. And in just 10 weeks, they noticed that their gut health improved substantially. And they actually had lower measures of inflammation. So now it's not speculation. Now it's fermented food for the win.
We're talking to Dr. Will Bolsowitz, gastroenterologist. His latest book is The Fiber-Fueled Cookbook, Inspiring Plant-Based Recipes to Turbocharge Your Health. Full phone lines. We'll get your calls in just a moment. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about gut health with Dr. Will Bolsowitz. His newest book is The Fiber-Fueled Cookbook. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Taylor starts us off in Madison. Taylor, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Taylor?
I just had a question about gas and bloating. Like, what causes that specifically?
I bet that's a question you get a lot, Dr. Bolsowitz.
Oh, my gosh. This is the number one. Hi, Taylor. Thank you so much for this great question. This is the number one thing that people want to know about, or a reason that they would go to seek a gastroenterologist. And, let me start off by saying this. Many people would be surprised to discover that they're constipated, even if they poop every single day. The number one cause of gas and bloating that I've come across is actually constipation. And constipation is not whether or not you poop once a day. You could even poop five times a day and be constipated. It's a question of whether or not you're completely evacuating your bowels. And so many people who have this issue, they actually will go, but they don't feel like they've completely emptied. And so this is one of the things that you can look for. This is a starting point in terms of evaluating gas and bloating. Now, going beyond this, it could be a number of different things, Taylor. There are dietary factors. It could be damage or injury to the gut microbiome. It could also be that some people actually swallow air. So they swallow air through carbonated drinks or sipping through straws or chewing gum, and the air has to come out one way or the other. But among all these things, if I were to start off with one thing, it would be gas and bloating from constipation.
Thanks for the call. Before we go back to callers, what do we do about that? If we're using the bathroom regularly, but still have, as Taylor mentioned, that bloating, how do we make sure we evacuate completely?
Yeah, so if you have this feeling that you're not completely evacuating, or if you're not going with great frequency, you know, one of the things to pay attention to is, does your gas and bloating improve after you have a good bowel movement? Because we all know what that feels like. You know, you have one of these moments where you strut out of the bathroom in slow motion and there's doves flying and, you know, it's fantastic. So how can we get things moving more efficiently? Because that's what we want. We want to have good, regular, complete evacuations. One of the things that I'll do, Rob, with my patients is actually have them start a magnesium supplement. Now, this is something that you're going to want to talk to your doctor about. Don't just hear this on Wisconsin Public Radio and then go and do it. But if you take a magnesium supplement, specifically magnesium citrate, magnesium sulfate, or magnesium oxide, you can start it before bedtime, typically 400 or 500 milligrams at bedtime. And over the course of time, you may slowly increase this. And you'll notice that this could substantially improve sort of the regularity or the efficiency of your bowel movements. And then if you notice that your gas and bloating improves with that, then you know you're on to something.
Thanks for that call, Taylor. Let's go now to Steve in Milwaukee. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, thanks so much for taking my call. I had a quick question about, you know, I travel constantly. I'm always on the road, and I find it difficult to, you know, keep aware of my diet and kind of eat healthy. I'm curious if you have any suggestions for somebody that's, you know, eating on the road more often, how to stay healthy.
Steve, thanks for the call. And I think the truckers listening are applauding that question. Dr. Balsowitz, what advice do you have?
Well, so thank you, Steve. A couple of things. First of all, one of the strategies that you want to use is to take advantage of local supermarkets when you're traveling. So look for a place where you can stop and like pick up some fresh produce. And I'm thinking about things like a snack. So things like fresh fruit, hummus, carrot sticks, things of this variety, just sneaking it in, just this by itself can be a difference maker. The other thing is that you want to start to pay attention. Like if you know where you're traveling to, take a little bit of time to check out the area ahead of time and have a plan. I feel that having a plan is one of the important things that people need when they're traveling, whether it's for business or for pleasure. You know, thinking about, okay, where are the places that potentially will have food that are aligned with what I'm looking for? That way you're not just kind of falling victim to, oh, I'm not really sure where I'm going to eat. And the last thing I would say is, like, depending on how widely you're traveling, you know, Steve, I'm not sure if you're in the car or whether you're in an airplane, but when you travel to a new place, you know, many times they have like a local food specialty. Find out what's in season, find out what sort of the local food specialty is, and try to hunt that down and try it out. That's, you know, one of the things that can be kind of fun actually is to invest into trying whatever the local seasonal dish is.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to gastroenterologist Dr. Will Balsowitz, author of books, the books Fiber Fueled and the Fiber Fueled Cookbook. Back to your calls now. Rita is with us in northern Wisconsin. Hi, Rita.
Hi. How are you today? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what did you want to ask about, Rita?
The question that I have is, I have Crohn's disease, so I'm not. I've been told that I shouldn't have fiber. That it's. Bad for my gut health, I guess, if I have fiber. So I have to have white bread, and I have to have white potatoes, and I have to have very bland things. What is his suggestion for me to do I do take a probiotic daily, and but other than that, what can I do to help?
Great question, Rita. Dr. Bolso, it's advice for someone with Crohn's disease.
Yeah, so people who have Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, I'll include both of these types of people, Rita. These are people who have inflammatory bowel disease. There's damage to the gut microbiome. The inflammation actually has caused injury to the gut microbiome. And because of that injury, you can struggle to process and digest these foods. So there's this sort of paradoxical thing where the food, specifically the fiber that you need so much to heal your condition, is actually the thing that you struggle with the most. Avoiding it doesn't actually make your gut stronger. So what you want is you want to, when you introduce these foods, you start super low and you go slow. So you don't go for the raw, monstrous salad, but instead you start off with things that you can tolerate, things like smoothies, soups, things that are cooked like stews, and you can slowly increase your fiber over the course of time. And this is actually a big part of what my new book, The Fiber Fields Cookbook, is about. It's not just a cookbook. It's actually a protocol for people like you, Rita, who want to add these foods, but they're trying to figure out how to do that.
Rita, thanks for the call and good luck to you in dealing with that. James joins us by Wisconsin Dells. James, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me on.
What'd you want to ask about, James?
My question was about the currently popular trendy kombucha. I enjoy it, and it's fermented, and you'd mentioned good fermented things earlier, and I wondered what the science says about that.
Thank you, James. Yeah, so I enjoy kombucha, too. I think that, you know, everything in nutrition, it's a question of what are you replacing with what. So if you were taking a, you know, Mountain Dew Code Red and replacing it with kombucha, well, that to me is a step in the right direction. We don't have a ton of science with regard to kombucha specifically. So my recommendation would be to consume this in moderation, meaning that I wouldn't really do more than 8 or 12 ounces per day. And then I would look to sort of broaden out the fermented food in your diet. So don't make it just kombucha, but instead, you know, look for those other things like sauerkraut and pickles and miso and tempeh.
Thanks a lot for that call. Appreciate it. I should ask, you've touched on this a little bit about, we've talked a lot about the good stuff, the good foods, which is a great way to tackle it. What are some of the things, though, that are not so great for our microbiomes?
You know, the issue, Rob, is that when things are consumed at a reasonable level, we don't have the same level of concern as when we're just going way overboard. And unfortunately, in American society, I mean, if you look at what our diet is made up of, first of all, we're not consuming the stuff that I'm talking about. The average American's diet is only 10% plant-based. And instead, 60% of our calories come from ultra-processed foods. These are things where basically the fiber is removed, but high in sugar, high in salt, high in preservatives and other chemicals, you know, and then 30% of our diet comes from animal products. It's not to say that you, like, for example, have to be vegan in order to be healthy. That would not be true. But I do think that if we could take some of this space, 60% being ultra-processed foods, let's replace that with plants. And then let's look at the rest, which is the animal products, and perhaps we increase our plant consumption a little bit. And what we would discover is all of a sudden we're 80 or 90% plants in our diet. That would be such a healthy improvement for us.
One more thing I wanted to bring up. You mentioned making fiber sexy again. You want to make oatmeal sexy again. You're a big fan of the oatmeal.
Well, I think breakfast is an awesome time to eat the way that I'm describing because you have tons of delicious options that can be not only do they taste good, but they're also good for your gut microbiome. So, you know, oatmeal is one example because what I like about oatmeal is I'm not talking about just like plopping down some oatmeal and then throwing some brown sugar in it. I'm talking about taking oatmeal as a foundation that you then are going to add more plants into. Things like walnuts, blueberries, blackberries, raspberries. I could keep going. You guys know where this is. You know, you guys have your own ideas out there of what to put in there. But the bottom line is that the oatmeal becomes a vehicle to deliver these fibers and these different plants into our diet. And all of a sudden, you're thriving.
Dr. Bolsowitz, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Will Bolsowitz is a gastroenterologist, author of the new book, The Fiber-Fueled Cookbook, Inspiring Plant-Based Recipes to Turbocharge Your Health. He joined us to talk about what we can do to improve our gut health. As we heard, fiber, a big part of the story. Fermented foods, also very good. If you have had a turnaround doing some of the things that Dr. Balsowitz has been talking about, let us know. And if you have a favorite way to doctor up your oatmeal, tell us about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org with your oatmeal secret recipe. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, check out the latest efforts by some healthcare workers in Wisconsin and elsewhere to join unions or rejoin them in some cases. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. I mentioned on the show yesterday exciting news. I am a big fan, as I've said again and again over the years, of the brown bears at Katmai National Park in Alaska. For some reason, stumbled across it. They have the live bear cams. Well, as of 11 a.m. Central Time today, the main bear cam is live. I'm looking at it right now. I'm just seeing a scenic river scene. They pan the camera around from time to time. Current report is no bears on camera. But earlier today, I did have some successful bear sightings. Looked like a mom and a couple cubs cuddled up by the river. Nobody in the falls yet, though I did see a bunch of fish. I'm going to guess salmon jumping around there. Some birds in the area. Some people identify them as mergansers. Those people were not me. I'm not very good at identifying birds. We've got a link. You can become a fan of the bears, too. It's at WPR.org/Central Time. Follow those bears. This is Central Time.